So what we're going to be talking about today, this is my big introduction, is automation systems. We all have them, we all use them, and things happen. And so I'm very fortunate that I was able to get a panel together here of really experienced automation engineers who will be able to talk us through this. And this isn't going to be necessarily about ransomware. This is just kind of an open discussion about failure modes, what you can do to prevent failures, how to recover from them, and maybe a couple of war stories. Plus, if you have any questions along the way, let us know, and we'll be happy to stop and answer your question. I'm not as much of an expert as these guys, so. For those of you who don't know, I'm Chris Tarr, back again, Director of Engineering for Magna Media, and with me, I'll let you guys introduce yourself. I'll start with Jeff here.
Jeff Ziegler from RCS.
Shane Tovin, SD Broadcast Associates.
Al Schermeister from Beasley Media Group.
And it's interesting that Al and I have the same background in our pictures. I wonder how that happened. Al and I have worked together in the past. So yeah, you just noticed that. So automation systems, we all have to fight with them, and they all have their own kind of sorts of challenges here. And what we want to start with is, what are some of the common failures that you see with automation systems? Could be anything, but what are the kind of the common failures that we see? We'll start with you, Jeff.
Well, I'm really glad that you pointed out that, ransomware is just one of many things. Statistically, I kind of took a look at where we see the failures, and it's still at least 2-to-1. That's hardware or self-induced failures versus external influence like a ransomware or something like that. So without a doubt, these are things that that you do have some control over.
Yeah, and to kind of tag along to that, I would say about 90% of the failures that I do see are self-induced operator error kind of things, like somebody forgot to program something on the log, or a template didn't get updated, or a game ended early and nobody planned for that on the log, or things like that. Thankfully, those things are pretty easy to identify and correct, and they're seldom catastrophic. I mean, it's inconvenient because it takes you off the air a lot of times. You don't have the right programming on the air, but they're not catastrophic in most cases.
So. I would have to agree with that as well, because a lot of it is programming too, that schedule stuff like that. But that we do run into the hardware aspect of things where things fail and. How do you stay on and keep things going while you're trying to repair things again? So that's another aspect.
So as you're installing these systems, what are the things, or even speccing them out, what are some of the things that you guys would suggest? If there may be some things to think about in terms of what might happen that I might need spares or parts for, or what should I have on the shelf in those situations? We'll start again with you, Jeff.
Yeah. Again, it's always nice to have hot spares online, but I also find that the old 3-2-1 methodology holds up still to this day quite well. And that is three copies of your data, your database as well as audio if they're separate, in at least two different locations, and one of those copies being offline, so that no matter if we're talking ransomware, if we're talking fire, flood. If a server goes down and I have another online, great, we can fail right over to it. But if both those locations are at a studio and that studio loses power, then we got to start looking at other locations.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the other trends that really can kind of help in terms of disaster recovery, in terms of system architecture, and more, we're seeing more and more automation vendors start to get into this now, is actually virtualizing a lot of the components of the automation system. So you can have one stack or several stacks of very robust hardware located in those multiple locations, synchronizing to each other and backing each other up. And that way, instead of having a physical machine that's kind of a big linchpin to your system, a single physical machine that's a big linchpin to your system, you can have these robust systems built in that have some kind of self-healing capabilities and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, for example, for us, we utilize the software that we use as failover modes. So if we have two pieces of equipment and one of them fails on it, it actually kicks over to the backup system. So now you're staying on the air and fixing the main server, as we want to call it, while that's happening. So The other aspect that we have is the ability, or at least for us, is we have a dedicated, what we call a national backup, where all our content is backed up there. So if something were to happen in the local market or that market, we can actually go on the air from a remote location using a Comrax access or something like that, and then use a URL stream or something. So.
And to clarify, you're using wide orbit at your
correct stations. For us, we use okay. wide orbit automation. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, as is the system that I'm currently deploying.
So. Okay. Yep. And you have is it RCS is
RCS is Zeta and yep, yep. and Next Gen, and both of them have remote solutions for being able to back up to multiple sites, and Zeta even has the ability to back up to the cloud, of course, too.
So yep. let's talk about real quickly for a good chuckle. I use Symbian at several of my stations. It doesn't have those sorts of things. So, you know, one of the things we do is we have a separate machine at a transmitter site with a database copy, and we keep the entire copy of the entire database, audio, everything, on AWS, so we can pull it back down if something were to happen. So it's not exactly the automatic types of backups that you're talking about, but there's always some way to back something up. So. You know, maybe it's a matter of being a little creative about how that works.
Yeah, I think you're right. Having you know, being able to have a copy in the cloud is a wonderful thing. Pull it down wherever you need it. If you can, setting it up so that you can actually launch it from the transmitter site, or a Plan B dedicated type of log, you know, that's similar but maybe slightly different, just something to stay going, that, you know, that's worth its weight in gold when you've lost everything else. So.
Yeah, now, cloud-based solutions are a great mechanism for disaster recovery approaches. And, you know, there are a lot of misconceptions about what that means exactly and what that looks like, but the thing is, it can take any number of forms. I mean, one really common disaster recovery scenario would be to just back up your data, kind of like you do, Chris, to a public cloud location where you can then later access this and bring it back online if you need to. There are other solutions out there now that'll actually give you a complete automation system in the cloud that you can access literally from anywhere. And that's, you know, that's another potential approach to use in a disaster recovery strategy.
I mean, some of the, you know, you're throwing stuff in the cloud and stuff like that. I mean, I guess you could consider like Microsoft OneDrive is cloud-based.
Absolutely.
So a lot of what you could do is a lot of your configurations, especially if you're trying, a lot of times people don't really back their stuff up. And then until something happens, they're like, oh, crap, I should have done that. but a solution to that sometimes is, you know, whether you're, you know, keeping it bare minimum or whatever, you could have batch files, sending stuff to like OneDrive for like configuration file aspect. So if something did happen and you didn't have the amount or the ability to really create just an automatic failover, that's one way to like, okay, fix it back up, and then I get my config files back from OneDrive, cloud, whatever, and go from there.
Yeah, but whatever strategy you do choose, you want to make sure that you test it on a regular basis.
Yes.
To make sure that that's actually happening. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard of, you know, sites that, well, we have our stuff being backed up to whatever it is, you know. But then they go to find it when they really need it, and they find out that that backup routine failed months or even, in some cases, a year or more
ago. Yep.
And they just never have looked at it. They thought, oh, we got it set up. Great. One other thing off the checklist. Done.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it's a constant thing. You have to test these systems. You have to make sure that they still, what you're doing still makes sense.
Well,
you
know, absolutely.
They have to be constantly evaluated and tested.
Yeah, not to mention you could have done a software update at the studio,
exactly.
Which now makes that backup nowhere near as valuable, if valuable at all, because you can't go backwards a lot of times. So this is definitely something that you definitely want to test your backup systems on a very regular basis.
Anybody ever had a database rebuild go sideways?
Yeah. Is that a thing?
Yeah. Oh, you mean that happens? So, you know, so we've talked a little bit about, you know, some of the potential vectors of failure vectors that are, you know, not software related. I mean, these are all, we're kind of talking about just really, you know, the hardware thing, which doesn't get talked about a lot, which is why I'm glad we're discussing it now. We've had plenty of sessions on, you know, ransomware and viruses and keeping your gateway secure, but very little discussion about, you know, that all has to run from something.
Mm-hmm.
And that something is just a computer, and computers are dumb.
Well, worse yet, you invest in a great cloud solution, you're running a server that's 7-8 years old, mm-hmm. and gee, right. it's still running good today, but you need to be thinking about that, you know, getting that replaced, because you will have a hardware failure.
And right. it seems like there are the automation vendors now, too, are coming up with solutions that are kind of work as part of the system. For example, I think Al can kind of go on this a little bit with, you know, something like Radio Server, where, you know, the clients can pretty much be wherever they need to be,
yep.
and they just
Correct.
Cache a copy of what they need and that sort of thing.
Correct, yeah. The is what Herbert calls it is Radio Server. So you have the physical playlist and the audio, the music spots, whatever,
right.
on a computer or machine or workstation. But then the client itself that the on-air personality or production person uses can be on a computer somewhere else, and they just bring up the shell, just a dumb front end
control.
Of it or
yeah,
whatever,
yeah,
dumb
yeah.
control
yeah.
in front of it. So
yep.
And that's also important because it seems like one of the potential issues is a failure in a building. For example, you know, you've got an automation system or something somewhere, and you can't access the playout part of that, you know, to be able to access something from somewhere
Absolutely.
To get back on the air.
Absolutely. And it's important to look at the architecture of these systems and how that works. Like, for instance, the current version of Radio Client will actually use local audio resources for playout and recording as well as server-based resources. So you can take that into account in kind of planning how your disaster recovery solution works, and other systems are very similar in
yeah.
that regard.
And in a related concept, restoration, we haven't really gotten to it yet, but when you're trying to restore your system, having the intelligence to be able to say, hey, here's the stuff, just doing a bulk load of, say, 2 terabytes is going to take a while. But if I can, I know I've got this song, this spot, whatever, coming up at the next hour, if my recovery system can be smart enough to say, get me those pieces first.
Oh, okay.
Right.
That
sure.
is a
right.
pretty big advantage.
It's, yeah, exactly. Like, for instance, again, not to get too vendor specific here, but Wide Orbit has a thing called island mode, basically, where
yep.
the client, if it can't see its central server, it'll go into what's called island mode and just start playing what it's got on its list and the content it knows it needs
locally,
to access.
Yes.
Locally,
so it doesn't worry about what's happening around it.
Right, which will get you through those kind of transient outages, basically.
Yep.
Yeah,
it seems like, you know, early on in the beginning of automation systems as we used them, you know, there was really kind of a hesitation to store audio anywhere but the local machine
right.
because we didn't trust it. And it seems like nowadays it's just become so robust that...
Well, the networks are so fast
right,
now.
Right.
I mean, that's the big change. You can actually pull it off.
Right. I remember trying to pull files off of DCS on a 10-base T
uh-huh.
network and trying to play them live, and it wasn't happening.
I just deployed a 10-gig backbone on our automation network, and, I mean, the cost of the hardware was so ridiculously cheap to do that 10-gig backbone and then 1 gig to your clients, mm-hmm. and you're covered. And, I mean, it's so much more robust now than it's ever been. So, yeah, we've kind of come full circle from having everything on that client to maybe trusting that more distributed architecture a little bit more again.
Well, and I think it's really common deployment across, I know our software does it as well as I'm sure most software does it. They were still playing locally,
sure.
but it wasn't out of necessity now. It's out of security.
And architecture, yeah.
You know, yeah.
yeah.
So, Al, you have kind of an interesting perspective because not only were you a support person for Wide Orbit, but now you're actually, you know, running Wide Orbit for a large broadcast group.
Yes.
Has that changed any of your thoughts about how automation systems handle things now that you're actually on the other side of that equation?
Well,
where you go, oh, I was selling that. I can't believe that. You know?
I've come to the conclusion right now that on this side of things, I can get feature requests a little bit easier than when I was there. And, I felt like, nobody needs that.
Yeah. I do remember doing several installs with you where you went, well, why would you want that? You know, now you know.
Yeah, now I know.
So we've gone through, planning for kind of a planning for failure hardware-wise. We've talked about some things on the cloud solution. We want to talk about a little bit about, because you started to touch on it, recovery.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's great that you've backed stuff up, and maybe you've double-checked your backups. I have been in a situation a long time ago where the backups failed. But that's all great. Something fails, and now you've got to get back together. And that requires probably not only the server and the playout system, but even options to what, you know, what do you do right now? You know, can we get files off of a server to play even on something, to get something on the air?
Yeah.
So what are some thoughts about that?
Again, having the local cache on the machines, I think most automation systems are doing this too, we can restore from that. So if you kind of distribute out and say, hey, control room number one's backing up station one, control room number two's backing up station two, we can pull that audio together to rebuild an entire database at one point. And the other thing is, again, if you have a sectioned backup. So you say I put all my spots here, all my songs here, whatever, or maybe a format level. Again, you can really hone down how fast you're restoring, what ways you're restoring from. And I think that's, you know, it's great to have a backup of everything, but sometimes you got to prioritize to get things going first.
Right. Well, and I'm a big believer in, you know, origination and playout capabilities at the edge, like at the transmitter site. Even if that's, you know, separate from your automation system, even if you have some kind of like solid state playback device, and I know these are becoming a little less common now, but they still have their place and they're still out there. Something that you can get on the air fairly quickly, you know, at the drop of a hat. So even if, you know, as a last resort, you've got some kind of, you know, playback device sitting there at the transmitter site just playing a loop. And actually, there are some manufacturers now that actually have this built into their audio processors as well.
I was just going to say that.
Cider, yeah. There's a lot of transmitter companies are building that in.
I was just going to say most modern processors now have a silence detector.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really how I do mine is because I, you know, again, Simeon. You know, I have a mirrored one at the transmitter site, and that's the second input on the processor. So if everything goes down, the processor will automatically switch to the running machine, and that keeps it going. But you could do that with, you know, I remember taking old sales computers and throwing Winamp on them with a playlist and putting it on old broadcast tools, silent sensor switch. So I guess there are many ways to do that.
So I bring up this story just because this is many years ago, and this is probably where everything got you know, as good as it is these days. Back in my wide orbit days, and I'm at an install, and I thought this was ingenious. They had Cool Edit. You know, we all remember Cool Edit. Some still have it, probably, if you can get it to run. And they had like an hour's worth of, you know, music or, you know, everything all on there. But the way the engineer hooked it up was if there was a silent sense, it triggered on the keyboard, like automatically, he had it wired into the keyboard so that it would hit play on Cool Edit. You know, this is like early stages of you know, let's get back on the air, fast and automatic.
Clever. Sounds a little dangerous to me.
It does, but it was
wrong
clever.
Wrong applications,
man. Yeah. Well, I saw something similar with emulating a joystick command, a USB joystick MIDI command or something. On a computer at a transmitter site, that same kind of situation. Fortunately, you know, I think we've kind of gotten past that. But that leads me to an interesting question that I'll pose to each of you, and you don't have to name names or anything. What is the kind of worst case disaster you've run into with the system? And it can be...
Oh, I got one.
I've got one, too. I think we all do.
I was going to say, I figured this would be an easy question.
This is an easy one.
For a lot of you. So, we'll start with you.
All right. So, I had a customer in Alaska that had a beautiful redundant system, and their rack room was actually in an off building because the studios were kind of small, and they had a garage that also doubled as the rack room. And the dual servers were beautifully stayed in sync until somebody went out and what first happens, something happened and one of the servers went down. The problem is the handoff was so smooth, nobody knew. Nobody ever went in there to hear the alarm beep, nothing. And so what finally took them off is, and this was like to the tune of weeks later, somebody went out there, and again, I don't know how they missed the alarm on this, but they plugged in an iron into one of the racks, overloaded, and this was the old gun irons, and overloaded the power and shut the other server down in that rack. Well, they were in the alternate rack, so it shouldn't have taken the original backup down, but the backup was already down. So yeah, the problem with automatic failure is If you didn't know it, hand it off already, and you were already running in a compromised state, you want to make sure that you have some form of foldback to let you know, oh yeah, you've got a problem, because that was the first question, was what happened to the backup? Well, your backup's been down for 2 weeks or whatever it was. It's a while ago now.
That is the technical equivalent of stepping on rakes.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Very much so. I have a similar story where I got a call from a station, they were completely dead in the water. Well, I mean, I knew they had a fairly robust server, right? You know, and it was RAID and all that, and they were supposed to have been, you know, backing up and all this stuff. Well, I hate to say this, RAID is not a backup. Thank you. It can and it will fail, and usually at the worst possible time. Well, come to find out, they had a RAID 5. Not only had one of their drives failed, nobody knew about it. Second one failed. Then, boom, they were down. And by some miracle, I managed to keep shuffling drives and managed to get the thing to come up and rebuild. But I have... After that, I strongly advised them to reevaluate their backup scenario. Because the backups, well, weren't. They thought RAID was their backup. And I'm like... No, that's not a backup strategy. That is a resiliency strategy, which is not the same as a backup or a disaster recovery strategy.
So I'll have to go takes us to one of our markets that are in Florida. So obviously Florida gets hit with a lot of hurricanes. So during our early stages of our testing international stuff, so Florida, I think it was 2 years ago. Our Florida market got hit with a hurricane, and the whole building is obviously out, and we're dead in the water. Transmitters obviously on generator, which is still functional, but we didn't have one of our local backup systems set up at that moment in time. However, we were just starting to test our national backup system, so in this disaster recovery, we were able to, from our Charlotte market, because the way they send logs to the system, they actually send logs through OneDrive, so they could send new logs to our Charlotte backup, and then we were on the air from Charlotte in Fort Myers transmitter site because the building itself was basically dead in the water down there. So, I mean, that to me was kind of a hefty, rather than just being off the air or playing, just some kind of music, we're actually playing the real stuff. We're playing spots and stuff like that. So that was kind of a big one for us.
And that's also something I think you want to think about in terms of not only disaster planning and planning for the recovery, is those types of situations. You know, what happens if you're in a situation where, there's a fire and your building is down? Obviously you have a lot of things to worry about, but do you have a plan? What would happen if that were to, if everything you have is in that building, you're kind of done.
Yeah, having three copies of data in that one building didn't
right,
do you much good.
Right, exactly. Right. And the other thing I think that needs to be looked at, and you guys can kind of chime in too, is one of the issues we deal with is differences in the hardware and software vendors and versions and things that we work with. I know Al and I ran into a situation in Milwaukee many years ago where all of a sudden our wide orbit network would go into island mode and everybody would get kicked off. And then all of a sudden, a couple minutes later, it'd come back on and we were scratching our heads. Well, it turns out that I had upgraded the network and replaced a 10100 switch with a gig switch, and the USB dongles for the licenses that talked to the two virtual servers didn't like it. And so they would connect, the dongles would connect, they'd see the licenses, and then it would disconnect. And it took forever to nail that down, and we ended up having to put in a dumb 10100 switch just for that device, and then put it on the network.
I can't tell you how happy I was when we moved away from hardware and dongles.
Oh my gosh.
So, that I think that also plays into, especially in a company like yours, a large broadcast group, where, do you start looking at some standardization in how you do things with hardware? Have you started working on that at all, or is that just a status quo for you?
No, we've standardized as far as like, you know, one of the hardware is hardwares. We actually we were doing virtual machines for a while on our central server stuff, but we've actually gone away with that because we're running into like more problems and then with the virtualization part. As cool as it sounds, it works. There's some things it's good for and some things it's not good for. So sure. We're sticking to the local workstations and stuff like that, standardizing on the equipment, because we have the ability to go radio server A, radio server B for failovers and so forth. So all the equipment along all our markets is all standardized and.
Well, you know, they say the good thing about standards is there are so many to choose from. What about you, Shane? I know you've just started with a new group. Are you any plans with anything like that?
So, in fact, we actually we're the guinea pigs for the Linux deployment of Wide Orbit.
Oh, you guys are it.
That's us. Yeah. So we actually have a stack of three servers running in kind of a I don't want to call them kind of a full cluster, but they're loosely connected. They're all managed with Xen. One of them is running the central server VM and all the kind of associated stuff in Docker containers. Another one is running two of the radio servers, and then the third is running two more radio servers. So okay. We have an RSA and RSB. Basically, each of those radio servers is running four of the stations, and they can all fail over to a live backup.
Nice.
So far, that architecture has worked fairly well.
Okay.
If I lose the one physical host, I lose my central server, but that just means basically everything goes into island mode when that happens.
Great.
But if I lose either of the other two physical hosts, then I lose, a set of radio servers, but they all fail over to their live backup and it comes up online. But again, standardization of hardware is a key here because that stack of virtual hardware is a standard set of hardware.
Yeah.
And we can deploy the same stack in other markets as well. So.
And not to get off because we're bringing up the software that we use.
Right.
And for those that don't really use that, and we say RSA and RSB, these are just like terms within the software that we use. But because of just to understand its ability for those that don't know that is the automation software itself can have just a single radio server that's playing your playlist. It can be an all-in-one box where it's just your automation system, but it has the ability for future expansion that you could have an RSA or RSB, which is your backup. So if you were on the air and all of a sudden A fails, mid-song kicks in B, and the worst that you get is a little blip.
Yeah, so these all come down to architectural questions as well. And every station, every installation is going to be different. So what works for one might not work for another.
Oh, exactly. Because we start talking about it, I just want people don't start.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't understand what they're talking about. RSA, RSB, that makes no sense.
The concepts are very similar among most automation manufacturers. It's just, we're getting into some specific vendor-specific stuff here.
And I think, with regards to virtual boxes, that if you don't already have the platform, it's pretty expensive to deploy. You're not saving a lot of money. It's an approach difference as opposed to a money saver, really.
Yeah.
Right. It comes down to whether you want to replace a bunch of boxes, for maybe less expense per box, or if you want to replace some really expensive boxes, but maybe replace them less often. That's really what it comes down to.
Exactly. So in terms of preparing, for disasters and potential issues, what are some of the best practices as you go to plan these systems? What are the things, and this time we'll mix it up a little bit, we'll start with Shane. What are some of the things you want to make sure to prepare for and look for when designing these systems for disaster planning and recovering? What are the things you need to go into this knowing?
Well, I'd say the first thing to look at is knowing your particular applications, knowing what your station's tolerance for risk is, because that's going to really inform the decision in terms of how robust you make these disaster recovery strategies.
Yeah, because some are really inexpensive and some are way down a rabbit hole.
Exactly. I mean, it can be everything from as simple as having just a physical set of media that's brought somewhere off-site to having massive virtualized and networked storage systems across multiple locations linked up with high-speed managed, wide area network connections and things like that. So it really comes down to just whatever you do, have a plan, document it, test it.
And I can't stress documentation more, yes. more than anything.
Yeah,
to,
absolutely.
To know, because especially if you're coming in from somebody else's work, and then you can't, you have no documentation, and you're like looking at a Los Angeles freeway, you know, yeah. it's all over the place.
Yeah.
So documentation as far as, you know, how you get from A to B. So.
Right. I'm in the middle of this transition right now from one system to another, and I'm actually having to reverse engineer what was done in the previous system,
yeah.
trying to figure out, okay, does this still make sense? And whether
well,
or not.
Well, and Al brings up a good point is, you may not be the one doing the recovery.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. train others, please.
Yes, yeah. So, you know, you know, this disaster may be fortunate and wait for you to leave to happen. So, you know, being able to document what you did and how it worked, it certainly makes, you know, all the difference in the world. And then there's also, and you mentioned, the phrase I use is tolerance for pain.
Right.
You know, in terms of how much are you going to spend or how far you're going to go down this rabbit hole, you know, I'll ask my boss, you know, well, what should we do? Okay, well, what's your tolerance for pain?
Right.
You know, is it off the air at all, off the air 10 minutes, an hour, 2 hours? At what point does that become painful? Okay, then we'll work backwards and find a solution that can fit that. Or if the pain is, I have a tolerance for pain for spending a whole lot of money. Okay, well, that certainly dictates things, too.
Well, and even in those cases, though, there are, like I said, there are some very simple and inexpensive strategies that you can deploy.
Sure.
In those cases.
Absolutely. Sure. You know, one thing that hasn't been talked about yet is programmatics of this thing. So if I'm taking a lot of live programming from satellite or some other source, and I have to shut down the studio and broadcast from the transmitter site, what am I going to put on the air? A lot of people who are doing long-form programming or whatever will store best ofs, evergreen material at the transmitter site. So they've already thought about this in advance because, you know, just replaying a specific dated thing can be a little less attractive to listen to than maybe a curated evergreen thing that you keep out there and kind of designed for just such a contingency.
That's a great point. Yeah, for instance, I mean, if you've got a sports news talk or a sports talk station that's pretty much satellite most of the time or a live, you know, ball game broadcast from somewhere, well, it's a little harder to do kind of evergreen material for that.
Yeah.
But if you've got like just stations that are running track music on hard drive, that's probably a little easier to take care of from a, you know, from a DR perspective.
So this brings up another thought of mine is what are good things to have in the toolbox kind of sitting at the ready to accommodate some of this? For example, you know, maybe for somebody it's, well, I can keep a, you know, I can keep a backup server or backup automation system in a different location, but I need to get the audio from there to the transmitter. So is it have a pair of barracks boxes? Does it have spare hard drives? You know, what are some of the things that you recommend having in a toolbox to kind of, you know, ease the pain a little bit as you try to recover?
Well, you know, I'll tell you, even if it's something as simple as, you know, a manual, you know, thing, like set up a link with CleanFeed or something from one site to another. I mean, that could be a great solution. CleanFeed is a browser-based audio codec, basically, that you can use to get audio from one point to another. Or a pair of barracks boxes will do it as well.
Sure.
There are
all
any
kinds
number
of
solutions
there. Yeah.
I would also suggest looking into you know, some inexpensive network-attached storage devices. You know, you can have those set up at multiple sites and have them set up to synchronize to each other.
Yeah. You can get 4 or 5 terabytes on a USB drive now, and that's pretty handy to have in the, you know, hey, as long as you update it on a semi-regular basis and you check it, that's a pretty
key.
Valuable backup.
I mean, you can keep it simple as just a cloned hard drive.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly.
Well, you made a good point, Al, with logs and things being out on OneDrive. Or,
yes.
Mm-hmm. We use Dropbox for ours, where we synchronize our logs everywhere.
We also kind of do that for a security standpoint as well,
sure.
using the OneDrive thing versus because, you know, you have so many people, like whether they're sending traffic logs or music logs or, you know,
right.
so many different computers and everything touching everything.
Right.
It's one of those things where rather than them touching multiple different parts of the automation system, now they're on their own computer touching the OneDrive,
yeah.
and
right.
we decide what goes up and what doesn't go
and
up.
And I think, too, that those solutions now have become security and reliability wise mature enough where, you know, I think, you know, several years ago people go, I would never put anything out like that. I'd have to be in our own hardware, and which kind of defeats the purpose, really.
Yeah, I mean, whether it be something like OneDrive or Google Drive or Dropbox, any number of those solutions are great for that type of application.
So you could, you know, in theory, have a hard drive with music, a computer somewhere, and then you've got a log on, you know, OneDrive or Dropbox or something, and you could throw something together and at least be back in business. Okay, that's and I think that's, you know, that's something that, you know, you can think about kind of in your spare time. And the best part about this, it sounds like, is that a lot of these things can be cobbled together from cast-offs. Yes. You know,
it doesn't have to be expensive, but do test it.
So I will make one good point about this. You don't want your backup systems to be less reliable than your main systems.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if you pulled some piece of hardware out, some ancient hard drive that's been sitting there spinning for however many years, and go, oh, okay, I'm going to use this out at my backup site or as my backup machine now to play audio. Well, you better make sure that it's at least going to be ready for you when you do need it. So that's
good
the
point.
One caveat I'll give to just pulling cast off hardware and reusing it for this purpose.
Yeah, and you can buy a lower end box,
absolutely.
But as long as it's new and up to date and somewhat reliable, maybe under warranty.
Like I just purchased a bunch of. I found out that the studio PCs at one site were just ancient. You know, really ancient. And I'm like, well, that's dumb. So I mean, you go on Amazon, you can buy, you know, some fairly recent machines for about $300 a piece with some really decent specs. And, you know, 1 terabyte solid-state drive in them and, you know, 32 gigs of RAM, and you just call it a day.
If you don't have the ability to, you know, to do that sort of thing or whatever and you have to cobble from older equipment, the mindset to remember is that should not be a permanent solution.
Absolutely.
That's just a temporary solution to get you by until you get your main, you know.
Radio station temporary,
Mike? Yeah. I was going to say, be careful about that.
Yeah, right.
And the other nice thing is, too, is with AOIP now, you don't have to accommodate big old sound cards anymore and such. So you can use those very small form factor PCs, which are notoriously inexpensive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And with the audio over IP drivers and things, there's... Which just need 2 network cards.
Brings alternate routing, brings a pathway, you know, over the public internet too. So it actually AOIP brings an awful lot to, hey, how do I get around when my studio goes down, get my audio from somewhere else?
A neat little trick that I do if you have a similar situation as mine is a couple of the audio processors I have are Omnias, which take as a failover LiveWire.
Yes.
And so I have a computer there with LiveWire drivers.
That's a great
connected
technique.
Right to the back of the processor,
and
there's your backup. So, yeah, it can certainly be done. So I think we'll slow down a little bit here and see if there's any questions or ideas or thoughts or, you know, if you guys have ideas about recovery or tips for that, we'd love to hear them, you know, share them with all of us. So if anybody has anything to say, they can raise their hand. Otherwise, we'll just keep going.
Wow,
okay. Oh, wait, there we go. I knew I could guilt a few people into it.
You mentioned that, you know, obviously a RAID is not a backup. It helps.
It does.
But also remember, if you decide to use a RAID to help things out, software RAIDs aren't the same as hardware RAIDs.
Correct.
True.
Very true.
I've been burned by software RAIDs, hardware, you know, just get a perk card.
Very true.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, especially for at your database positions and pieces like that were very critical. If it's a sales access machine, okay, maybe software RAID's just fine. But
all right, question for Shane and for Al, my wide orbit guys. What are your
I don't know about that.
My wide orbit brethren, what are your thoughts on solid state drives? You mentioned something about that just a minute ago, Shane. In particular, the read writes, they're getting better and better, of course, as the drives improve. But I've heard of a lot of stations that are doing solid states for the OS and main operating systems, but for voice tracking and things that we're recording and re-recording on a lot, they've been going to spinning drives.
I'm using SSDs throughout. All of my virtual hosts have a main kind of RAID array for them. Yes, they're backed up. all of the virtual hosts all have the RAID array on them, and they're all SSD in that array. And I think the wear leveling on a lot of these devices has gotten a lot better now than it used to be. So, I mean, the failure rate is certainly still going to be much more tolerable.
What are you finding for a lifespan?
I haven't had one fail yet, so I couldn't tell you.
Well, that's good news.
But yeah, definitely the solid state. I mean, not just for OS, at least in our aspect, we're actually using solid state for OS and audio storage.
Right.
Yeah. And playing off those drives.
Yeah. Same thing. That's our recommended spec is SSDs.
Yep. So, and just not disaster recovery, but what are we looking at nowadays for memory for these playout devices?
Yes.
All of it.
All of it, please.
Okay.
Are you running Audition?
No. Yeah. Well, one thing I've observed about the current versions of Windows is that they will use whatever you throw at them. And I believe that, you know, I mean, that's kind of by design. They handle the memory management pretty effectively. I mean, you might take one look at it at first and go, why is my Windows eating up all 32 gigs of my RAM? Well, it's actually managing that among the applications that need it as they launch. But I typically like to say, I like to see 32 on these systems, but that's 30, just me.
32,
yeah.
Even if you see this spec saying that, you know, oh, 16 is fine, 16, I usually double it.
Yeah,
wait, 16
triple
is
it.
A minimum for
right.
us. So.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, well, we just have a couple of minutes left. If anybody else has anything they want to ask, speak now or forever hold your peace. All right, well, thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate you taking the time out to do this today. Again, we talk so much about, you know, the software, you know, ransomware and that sort of thing and you know, people hacking into networks that, you know, we very rarely talk about.
It's a good headline.
Planning to fail, right. It's that's sexy.
Yeah.
But the, you know, just a general hard drive failure, you know, nobody ever really talks about that. But it's, you know, a lot of times people, and I'm guilty of it, once it's in and running, I move on to other things.
Hardware is the most common source of failure.
Short of operator.
Yeah. So there you go. Be safe. You know, RAID is not a backup. Plug in your RAID drives, back them up. And, you know.
SSD and RAM.
SSD and RAM. There you go. There are your tips. Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.